Two cases, both stabbings, both charged with murdering their boyfriends. One woman out of Wisconsin says it was a suicide. A jury has decided her fate. Another woman in Florida says it was self-defense as she awaits her murder trial. Thank you for joining me on another episode of Killer Jeans. I'm Melissa.
They want justice. They want answers.
What stands out to you about his personality?
What's the family want most of all?
But you were just the last person to see her.
There's an arrest warrant. In Lee.
You have a lot of weighty accusations.
On a hot July evening in Appleton, Wisconsin, July of 2024, two friends buzzed into an apartment on Park Drive Lane and found 35-year-old Joseph Joey Carnot on the kitchen floor, a single chest wound just under the left nipple, a kitchen knife later photographed in the sink, and minutes ticked by before 911 was called. When first responders arrived, they sealed the wound and worked to save him, but they could not. The state's medical examiner would later clock the fatal path of the wound, a 6.2-centimeter stab wound penetrating the rib cartilage, with roughly 300 milliliters of blood pooling around Joey's heart. He examined that a victim might remain briefly conscious, but would quickly lose their fight without immediate care. Crucially, he testified the autopsy alone would not say whether the wound was self-inflicted or a homicide. There were two defensive wounds, but their absence didn't rule out murder. Toxicology found methamphetamine and other drugs in Joey's system, though those drugs did not cause his death. Prosecutors charged 40-year-old Samantha Krebs, Joey's live-in girlfriend, and by her account, his fiancée. She was charged with first-degree intentional homicide. Now, from the prosecutor's perspective, from the very beginning, they said she pushed a suicide narrative, that Joey stabbed himself, and in the criminal complaint and at trial, a witness who arrived after the stabbing reported that moments after Krebs told them, "Just tell police he stabbed himself," she then kissed Joey, said she loved him, and left. One friend recalled her saying, "I can't go back to prison," as she had a record and was on parole at the time. A jury would be asked to sift through motive versus panic, truth from cover story. Samantha's friend and witness that day was John Pfeiffer, who she's known for many years, and John was supposed to be headed over to the house earlier in the day, but he was running late, so by the time he showed up, Joey was already on the floor bleeding out. He and his girlfriend tried to stop the bleeding and to resuscitate him. His pulse was weak, and Joey tried to get up. At one point, he was hanging on by a thread, and while John catered to his wounds, he called two paramedic friends who didn't answer and then called 911. Let's pause here. Two paths at this point that police could take. One is plausible. A woman on drugs, on meth, with her boyfriend also on meth. They got into a fight, tempers flared, drugs ignited the distorted minds, and he stabbed himself in a presumed reaction of a meth head to want to run, whether she did it or not. Running out of fear. And already having a record on parole, that makes sense. Now, if she stabbed Joey and the words, "tell police he stabbed himself," which can be taken either way, if she did it in a drug-induced state, she'd have marks on her hand, unless he was completely out of it, limp, as in some cases with meth highs can cause that. Would a stabbing motion such as that cause a mark on her to penetrate a body? And does she have the strength for that to make a clean cut that deep without showing any signs of defensive wounds? These are all things to look out for. Now, Samantha, she didn't want to call for help right away because she was in a drug-fueled save-yourself mentality of hiding the drugs and leaving. On audio recordings, Samantha says, "tell police he fell on a knife." And her friend John says, "I don't know." Now, to me, this is becoming more clear. It's a bunch of addicts trying to cover for each other, panicking. But was it murder or an accident? Who has a hold of that knife first? Who had it? Investigators found out, and they collected video and body cam, and matched timestamps and reconstructed movements against the 911 call. Arrivals at 9:46 p.m., the 911 call at 9:54 p.m., and officers at the door by 9:59. They also found a green binder on a bed at the apartment where Krebs stayed afterwards, and detectives described it, what was in it, a play-by-play from her perspective that night, a fight, a threat, that if she left, he'd stab himself and make it look like she did it. It read like a script written under pressure, maybe a diary, maybe a defense, maybe recounting the truth before it fades into a fog state of her drug-induced mind. Samantha testified during her murder trial, recounting several moments of delusional erratic behaviors and drug use in the past. And at one point, Joey reportedly was seeking help from the VA for his drug use. Now, Joey served in the National Guard for several years, and he relied on Veteran Affairs Services for mental health care. Samantha's emotional testimony detailed Joey's childhood traumas and him not taking his medications routinely. Leading up to the incident, he was, she says, off his medication. She said both of them were doing meth, and she said the day of the murder, he was up all night, got zero sleep from the night before, but he still went to work, sleep deprived. And afterwards, she said she was just coming home from the gas station with her friend John, and Joey was home. They all did meth. And then she says Joey was just antsy and getting angry because he wanted to do more, asking a friend to go out and get more. That's when John took off and left in the house for three people, the couple and another friend. So this sounds like a drug house to me, basically, you know, just a revolving door of people, friends who did meth together, coming and going. She says Joey secluded himself in the bedroom, what he often does, through paranoia from drug use. He was texting her while in the other room, and she told the friend to leave because it was escalating. It was just the two of them at this point. He was texting her to give him some of her oxy pills that were inside the bedroom. She says he finally comes out, and he was super hyper and high at this point, and he was about to leave the apartment, reportedly to get some more drugs. And she tried to talk him out of leaving because he was so high. So she said it was him who was in this extreme state of delusion. He was emotional. She said it was a routine emotional breakdown when he was high. So she went to sit on the couch, put on her shoes, and he threw a knife. She threatened to leave, and he threatened to stab himself. She says he came out of the kitchen holding his side with a bloody knife gripping the side of him. He falls down and is on the ground, and that is when the doorbell rings. It is her friend John and his girlfriend. They had returned. Amongst the chaos, small bits of it caught on audio. She said that it was her friend John who said he could call police for help while attending to Joey. She said John said he was going to call 911, and it was his idea to get the drugs from the house and to leave. She said John kept telling her to leave, so she then kissed him goodbye and said, "I love you," and then left because she was on meth. She didn't want to be caught. John also verified in court that he did tell her to leave the house. I can absolutely see this scenario playing out as well. You know, she said that the wound was one that she thought he would recover from. It wasn't such a big deal, a few stitches and he would be okay. So she left. This is either an accidental suicide with his mental state, or this is cold-blooded murder. In finding the truth, what is undeniable is Samantha chose to leave and save herself, to flee the scene, knowing her boyfriend, the man she was supposedly going to marry, was bleeding out. She chose to leave because she was on parole. So who were these two people at the center of this murder or suicide case? Joey Carnot grew up in Appleton. He served in the National Guard after high school and then drove dump trucks for a concrete company. He was the kind of dad who loved going on bike rides with his son, loved car races, the Packers, the Brewers, and he was even a Warriors fan. His family remembered the beaming smile and a big room energy that he had at church with his friends and with his son, all pillars in his life, except he did struggle, openly struggled with drug addiction. Struggles, they mattered By 2024, Joey was clawing at sobriety. Texts put him in reaching out for help, planning a drug test, even texting a friend for clean urine the evening that he passed away. A drug test, which was a detail prosecutors highlighted to challenge any claim that he was suicidal 10 minutes later. Ex-co-workers of his told police that Joey had confided that his fiance threatened to stab him multiple times. He said the threats, they were repeated, not a one-off. Now, Krebs, for her part, told the jury that they were engaged in planning a future together, that both had wrestled with meth addiction, and that Joey, when high, would go in this very delusional state of mind. The night itself became a tight coil of minutes. In court, jurors heard an audio clip captured just minutes before the 911 call, and testimony painted a very hectic scene. Joey on the floor, bleeding out. A friend, John's girlfriend, she was trying these sternum rubs and compressions. A knife later seen in the sink. Now, the state said Krebs prioritized hiding drugs over dialing 911 and left with a bag and then changed her story. That she was not there, then he fell on the knife, and then he killed himself. And the defense said she panicked. She was on probation, terrified of police contact, and genuinely believed another friend was going to call 911. They argued that bad choices over a tragedy aren't proof of intent to kill. Making this more difficult for a jury is the forensic details. It cuts both ways. In opening, the state told jurors DNA placed Joey's DNA on the blade and both Joey and Samantha's DNA on the handle. Later, the defense hammered that there were no DNA linking whatsoever of her to the knife, reflecting the defense's read of the lab evidence and emphasizing reasonable doubt. Now, the medical examiner's careful review said he couldn't declare homicide or self-infliction from the wound alone, and it became the centerpiece of the defense, saying, if the science doesn't choose, neither should you. That would be powerful. That would be conflicting. Other pieces became character evidence. A custody fight over his son with his ex. Joey desperately wanted to win. A relapse that threatened his job. And two narratives of the couple's dynamic. The prosecution described a kind Joey making future plans set against a defendant who was messed up, moving to hide drugs and control the story. The defense insisted Joey was spiraling, that Krebs loved him and was looking forward to being a stepmother, and that her inconsistencies were just simply trauma from an addict, not a killer. Jurors also heard from the people in the doorway that night, the witnesses and friends. John admitted changing stories to protect Samantha, moving drug paraphernalia and deleting messages. Another, his girlfriend, on the phone with 911, said Samantha was there and left. The property manager said the locks were changed after Joey's death, and detectives later arrested Krebs at a friend's apartment and noted efforts to conceal her car's identifying decals, the plates. The state argued those steps showed consciousness of guilt. The defense, they just called it fear. During cross-examination, the prosecutor zeroed in on the minutes where Samantha was, what she knew about the wound under the left nipple gushing, and why she didn't call 911 as fast as she could have. He confronted her with texts to friends after the stabbing that prosecutors framed as early alibi building. Krebs testified she thought someone else had already called, that she feared a probation violation if police found drugs, and that she believed Joey would survive the wound. She denied stabbing him. In closings, the state called the suicide story contradicted by the evidence, pointing to Joey's future-oriented text minutes before he died. He said showed Krebs prioritizing drugs over aid. The defense told the jury to separate facts from speculation, reminded them that intent, not motive, was the legal linchpin, and argued the state hadn't proved it. The question, did she or didn't she, wasn't rhetorical. It was the standard beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, what people don't realize if they've never dealt with addiction in their family is that someone can love you to their core. They would kill for you. They love you more than they love themselves. But if an addict, the drugs, the fix, the addiction is stronger than love, it takes a hold of them. It takes over. It takes the original version of what you thought was them, and it changes who they are chemically. And you are no longer the priority. It's the addiction. It's the self-preservation mode. I've seen it, and I understand that both arguments are very plausible when it comes to two people high on meth and what could happen, could not happen. What I find is key is the depth of the stab wound, the thrusting of it. I find it amazing. The medical examiner can't say for sure from the angle of the stab wound if a person could do that to themselves or not. So that makes it much harder for jurors. And in covering many murder trials, I've learned what does play a role in jurors that may not be 100% sure is mannerisms, character, and behaviors after. It's, to me, always a deciding factor in how jurors make their decisions. And on September 11th of 2025, just days ago, after roughly 5.5 hours of deliberation, a jury of 7 men and 5 women returned its answer, guilty of first-degree intentional homicide. The judge revoked the $1 million bond on the spot and set her sentencing for November 25th. Under Wisconsin law, Krebs faces life in prison. The judge may set a parole eligibility date or impose life without the possibility of release. And yet the human story isn't just, of course, a docket number or headline. Joey's obituary fills in the quiet spaces the courtroom can't. National Guard service, pride in his work behind the wheel, a faith that steadied him, teams he rooted for, and a son that he loved and adored. Whatever happened in that 10-minute window before help was summoned, those are the facts of his life. So did she or didn't she? The jury has spoken. And when found guilty, Samantha just bowed her head in disbelief and quietly sobbed. This case is now known as the Kill and Kiss Murder. And the decision for her to run when her fiancé lay dying. Now, from one stabbing murder in Wisconsin to another in Miami, Florida, another girlfriend of a man killed facing trial. But this one seems to have suspicions not only in the evidence, but in the antics of the DA's office. Are they playing fair in the murder trial of an OnlyFans model charged with murdering her boyfriend? Let's get into it, because that's the question. Defense attorneys, they want front and center as Miami's prosecution of Courtney Clenny moves towards a trial. Clenny, known online as Courtney Taylor, she's an OnlyFans model. She is charged with second-degree murder with a weapon for the April 2022 death of her boyfriend, 27-year-old Christian Toby Obumsely, inside their high-rise condo in Miami's Edgewater neighborhood. She says she acted in self-defense. Prosecutors say the evidence tells a different story. And the trial will have plenty of audio and video recordings to help sway jurors in their decision, as this couple led a tumultuous, toxic life. And the victim, Obumsely, seems to secretly record some of the outbursts, as I would assume, gathering evidence in case it's ever needed. And a potentially incriminating attack seen online everywhere of the couple inside of an elevator. Now, before the courtroom wranglings, there was a couple at one point very much in love. Christian, friends and family called him Toby. It's his nickname. He was born April 12, 1994, a Dallas area kid who grew up into a young man known for warmth and hustle. He was 1 week shy of his 28th birthday when he died. He recently moved to Miami, working in cryptocurrency, and was a Plano East Senior High alum, still tightly bound to his Texas roots. And in the dates that now mark his family's new reality is April 3rd of 2022, his death. His loved ones remember him as extremely compassionate, the kind of person who lifted those around him. Courtney, who used her middle name as her last, Courtney Taylor, on social platforms, started making makeup tutorials, and then she eventually turned into becoming a fitness model with a very bubbly personality. And at 21 years old, she joined OnlyFans, like millions of people, and her parents didn't quite approve, but Courtney, she was making so much money doing it, she just stayed with it. The couple met on vacation the old-fashioned way, meeting out in the wild, and they just hit it off. They clicked instantly. After months of dating, Christian and Courtney moved in together at the time in Austin, Texas. Christian, who was business savvy, helped with her content and making her business decisions. Friends, they noticed constant arguing and jealousy escalating. In attempts to salvage the relationship, the couple decided to move to Miami. It's apparently the capital of OnlyFans content creators. So the morning of his death, the couple, they were seen captured in this video dancing and laughing and playing with their dogs, and then you cut to the 911 call. Christian is saying, "I can't feel my arm," and Courtney is saying, "I'm sorry, baby." Police body cams show her asking, pleading to go to the hospital to be with him. But at that point, she's now a suspect, and it looks like domestic violence. Police, they start digging into the couple, interviewing residents at the building. There were at least 8 complaints of noise and ruckus that had been documented on the two of them. One resident reported seeing, through his window, Christian hitting Courtney and her falling to her knees. Multiple reports coming in of violence leading up to this, but it's hard to decipher who was the provoker. Or was it both of them? Were they both physical with one another? Days before his death, police were called to the apartment after she broke up with him and he reacted badly. So she tried to file a restraining order against him, but it never moved forward. So she allowed him back in the apartment, and then just days later, this last final fight broke out. The relationship and the killing. Prosecutors have described the couple's relationship, along with many of her friends, as just combative, explosive, dating back to late 2020. There were 2 pieces of evidence that quickly started to shape this case. This elevator video back in 2022, it was released to the public. It appears to show, and from what I see, Clenny just wailing on Obumsele, just wailing on him and him not fighting back, just kind of pushing her away. This secret audio he recorded weeks before the stabbing, recordings captured Clenny berating him and also using a racial slur. From the start, Clenny claimed it was self-defense, telling investigators that she was talking to her mom in the moment during the argument, and at some point it escalated and she grabbed a knife as a threat to basically stay away from me, don't come near me, as to defend herself. He was about 10 feet away when he pushed her and knocked her down. He had stepped back, and that's when she said she just threw the knife at Obumsele to scare him, just to get him away. But the Miami-Dade medical examiner concluded the fatal chest wound was about 3 inches deep into a major artery. Could not have been caused by a knife just simply thrown at someone from a distance. Investigators described the angle as a forceful, slightly downward stab. And the medical examiner's report, it will be critical to this murder trial, the center focus of it. But it seems both sides were guilty of abusive behaviors. But the placement of the knife wound, the depth, the angle, it will all come into play to determine guilt or innocence, heavily based on forensic and also past behaviors. Clenny was arrested in Hawaii, coincidentally at a rehab facility in August of 2022, and that's when she was extradited to Miami and ordered to be held without bond. The judge repeatedly denied her release pending the trial. Now, 2 narratives must be built. Who was the aggressor and the victim? For this, lifestyle comes into play. Courtney, confirmed by friends and her accounting, was clearly the breadwinner. She provided this lifestyle that they led. lawyers will both use that to paint a picture of who was more desperate in losing the other. Courtney had been arrested in the past in Las Vegas. She was charged with domestic violence for throwing something at him. The charges were later dropped. So that paired with videos that Christian secretly recorded of Courtney, there was enough evidence, obviously, to charge her and move this thing to trial. Now, the defense, the thrown knife theory, they pushed back really hard on this. At an October 24 hearing, the defense played a now infamous pig carcass knife throwing video with expert testimony arguing a knife could be thrown to replicate that kind of wound. Prosecutors countered that the demonstration used was a different thrower, obviously a man, different conditions and didn't match the specifics of the case. So the judge didn't find it persuasive enough to change Clenny's custody status, so she was still held without bond. Then you have this fairness fight, privilege digital burglary. That's what it's being referred to. In 24, the case took a sharp turn. A Miami-Dade judge ruled prosecutors violated attorney-client privilege when they accessed private family group texts and other communications tied to the defense team. In the wake of that ruling, the state dropped separate computer crime charges that had been filed against Clenny and her parents relating to access of the victim's laptop, which isn't supposed to happen. Even as those charges were dismissed, disputes continued over whether seized hard drives segregated after the privilege breach should be returned. Now, the defense described the state's access of iCloud data as a digital burglary. They shouldn't have taken it. They shouldn't have had it. In 25 of this year, earlier, Clenny's team moved to disqualify the entire Miami-Dade State's Attorney's Office, citing the privilege issues and the lead prosecutor's withdrawal. That's huge. Now, a judge also allowed defense attorneys to question prosecutors about what privileged content they saw. The state has maintained that corrective steps were taken and that the homicide case should proceed. This is a lot of drama behind the scenes. Now, here's the latest. The motions to dismiss. Recently, defense attorneys filed a motion to dismiss the murder case altogether, alleging the state viewed defense strategy materials and privileged group texts, which was labeled Team Courtney. It committed a Brady violation by not disclosing a neighbor witness, Arthur Cupp, who allegedly reported seeing that Mimselli wailing on Clenny in the days before the stabbing, and that they committed a young blood violation tied to a civilian's photo from the scene that were allegedly destroyed at police direction. All of these claims, they're now before the court. So for listeners, a Brady violation is when prosecutors failed to disclose material exculpatory evidence that could help the other side. That's not a fair fight. The young blood refers to the due process limits of failing to preserve potentially useful evidence. So, geez, what is going on in Miami? Regardless, both sides, they need to play fairly and work with the evidence that they have or don't have. So this is where it all stands present day at this point. Mid-September of 25, coverage indicates the court has set a trial date. This is going to move forward despite all this behind-the-scenes drama, December 1st of this year. Clenny remains jailed without bond. Pretrial motions, including the new motion to dismiss, could still impact the timing and the scope of it, but I think it is going to move forward regardless. Behind the filings and the headlines, there is, of course, the grief of a family who learned of Toby's death. His parents and brother have described the devastation and the pursuit of accountability in both criminal and civil wrongful death suits. They've spoken about Toby, how he was a generous spirit and a young man who had plans. He was a son and a brother whose absence is ever present every single day. What a jury may hear when the case goes to trial on this current schedule of December 1st, they can expect to see an abundance of video and audio. You've got this now infamous for this case, the elevator footage. body camera footage from the aftermath and the 911 call, autopsy findings about depth and angle of the fatal wound, audio recordings secretly captured before the killing that prosecutors say show escalating volatility. The defense's thrown knife theory, with the expert using that pig carcass demo saying that a thrown knife is plausible. And they may also hear about the privilege breach and the court's remedy depending on, you know, if it's allowed in or not. So is the state playing fair on this case? Well, judges have already found lines were crossed in the handling of privileged communications. Whether that misstep taints the homicide prosecution enough to derail it is exactly what is new. I don't think it will. I think it's just going to move forward. But what's certain, what can't be litigated away, is the loss at the heart of this story. It is the death of Christian Toby Omoselli, 1 week shy of his 28th, and the family that still says his name every single day, and the woman whose parents stand by her, who believes she was a victim of ongoing domestic abuse and was defending herself that night by throwing a knife, which had a fatal ending. This trial is going to be full of emotion, and I am definitely going to follow this one closely. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Killer Jeans. We'll see you on the next one.